Major Jefferson, Reel 5. We were discussing the importance of written orders.
Well, in the situation that I'm thinking of that night, I would be most surprised if any written orders were even considered. It's possible the general received some written orders, but again, I'd suspect he probably had a word from the Orc and knew the background to the strategy and didn't need any written orders. But I should be most surprised if the Colonel of 11th Field got any written orders. It would have been superfluous. Apart from that, it wouldn't be very practical. We arrived there late evening and had just time for a brew up and get ready to move, and moved. And it was dark by the time we moved. It would have been easy to read written orders, let alone write them. But in any case, we didn't need them because we were trained in desert warfare. And I think I said earlier that there were occasions in the desert when one was actually driving along at 30 miles an hour and suddenly stopped and said, "Troop action down the telegraph lines, 2,000 yards fire." Everyone knew what to do if that happened. You expected a round on the ground in 2,000 inside 1 minute, and you could then correct it, and orders were to some extent superfluous. And you know, when you were first mentioned this and you suggested that perhaps there was some disparity between what one learns at school and what one practices in action, and this exactly the same is true in relation to observation of fire. I spent many happy hours standing on the top of a tank or standing on the top of my armoured observation car with a blue and red fore and aft cap on with a golden button, smoking a cigarette and looking at a German some thousand yards away doing exactly the same thing at me. Of course, with the false crest in between, we had no idea exactly how far away we were from each other, and in complete safety. But the thought of anyone smoking a cigarette on an exercise on Salisbury Plain before the war was blasphemy. So there is indeed a difference between what you do in action and theory. That having been said, I am quite certain that there are moments when written orders are not only necessary but essential. And I'm not against written orders, but I do think that when you've been on active service for any length of time, you know what those orders are going to be before you get them. Yeah.
You're mentioning this business of getting into action within a minute of something. Did you have to go into action during this breakout?
No. Yes. Yes and no. The armoured OP screen was the people who fired a few shots with a Bren or something and got these seven German prisoners. That was going into action in one sense. The next morning, we went into action on one or two occasions. If you were interested at all in the detail, I'd have to look them up. But certainly the column went into action on one occasion when we were having breakfast and we were overlooked by probably a German scout car. We all got a bit panicky, and so we all put trails down. I don't know whether we fired. If we did, it was only one shot, and they didn't come back because they were probably more scared than we were, because we probably outnumbered them, which we didn't know at the time. And a later date, we dropped into action and attempted to engage the 1st Armoured Division. And this is when I just said, I think a little earlier, that an armoured division on the ground occupies an enormous area. And they were raising lots of dust, and I don't think they had any tanks, or if they did, there were very few of them transporters. But we dropped our trails and threatened to take them on.
The British 1st Armoured Division?
British 1st Armoured Division, yes. Fortunately, we didn't. But I don't think we actually had any artillery action in between Matru and getting back behind the Alamein line. We had the odd scuffle, that was all.
Now, you mentioned these Germans who were taken prisoner, who were put into the back of your truck.
Yeah, yeah.
Which formation did they come from, do you know?
No, I don't. They weren't with me for very long. They were a cause of great worry to me, and in relation to what we were discussing at lunchtime. Because it would be the night of the 28th or 29th of June. My 24th birthday was the 29th of June. I should think it would be the night of the 28th. The darkness was falling. And I had my 1500-weight truck and 1 3-tonner behind, and my staff of a couple of sergeants or so in my own truck, and perhaps two chaps in the 3-tonner, and 7 or 8 German prisoners. The darkness was falling. And I don't think I ever very seriously considered it, but I mean, the thought does have to cross your mind then, what do I do with these chaps? Do I shoot them, or do they shoot me? And it's as simple as that. And fortunately, I think I got rid of them when we took on the 1st Armoured Division. I think that they took my worry off me. I'm not quite certain, but they certainly were taken off me. But equally certain, when I read of people getting hot under the collar at so-called atrocities, I realise that at a given moment you have this decision to take. I don't think I ever got close enough to that decision for it to be really worrying, but except the fact that I even approached it to where it's been many years later.
What did you carry as a personal weapon?
Oh, a 3.8 at that time.
What do these Germans look like? What sort of impression did they make on you?
Oh, they were scruffy young lads. And they were fairly skinny, blonde young chaps. I remember they had their fore and aft bluish cap with the roundel in the forehead. And they were perfectly nice young ordinary chaps. Skinny, fairly. Young, fairly. But I didn't speak a word of any other language except English at that time. Oh, yes, I did. I spoke some Arabic. But no European languages other than a bit of French. And so we didn't have a very long conversation. And, you know, they merely wished upon me, and I eventually got rid of them.
What did you do with them? Just put them in the back of the truck and drive on?
Oh, they were in a 3-tonner. I mean, I was in my 1500-weight, and this 3-tonner, it must have been one of these spare ammunition trucks or something like that. I can just see it tagging on behind me. I'm not all that conscious of how they got there. I know when they were taken by Major Paul and Pat Waterfield, and I know that they weren't with me as darkness fell that night. But I equally know there was something worrying to me in the course of the day. Because by now, having led the battery from Iraq to the desert, I was now, what is politely known as Backstop Charlie, because as CPI had no immediate responsibilities in a desert formation when all we were concerned with was what was over the next ridge. So by now I was some way behind the regiment by the time we got to the 1st Armoured Div.
What sort of distance were you maintaining between vehicles at that stage?
I think the drill was 150 yards, I think. Maybe 185, but I mean, it was a figure of that sort. And over most periods, we would normally do that. But I think by the time I'm thinking of, when we hit the 1st Armoured Division, I think I was some way behind. I can see myself at the moment going down a lengthy coombe, and the regiment disappearing over the crest, and me getting slightly worried whether I was going to be left behind or not. and that would be just before the first armament.
Presumably you had to maintain some sort of line of sight with your...
Well, if you could, but I mean, they weren't going to stop for you if you had a breakdown, or if you... Because as Backstop Charlie, one was whipping in and...
Did you have the LAD with you?
They were behind me, I hope. But my memory of certain minutes in this is absolutely sharp as crystal. But the other bits, all I can go on is our general behaviour in certain conditions. And the bit you're talking about now is more general behaviour in certain conditions than being absolutely crystal. Well, this crystal is the next day, and by now the distance between me and the vehicle behind and vehicle in front was the right distance, whether it was 150 or 185, and there over, and we were by now on the metal road, so we've gone south, we've turned east, and we've come north again, and we're on the metal road, and we're some way between Darba and Alamein, and the road is absolutely deserted except for us going that way down it. And in the distance, there's one of these sand-coloured estate wagons, not like my own estate wagon, but sand-coloured, made of wood rather than metal, and one armoured car behind it. And there is the Orc grinning broadly. This is the picture that's in John Connell's book, but I think we were a bit further out than John Connell's picture even. And it's a picture that was also taken by Jeff Armstrong in 11th HAC, who also joined our column later. But his appearance was exactly as John Connell described it to us, enormously comforting, and he let it be known that he was pleased with our march discipline.
What sort of distance would you maintain if you were going at night?
Well, again...
when you set off in the dark...
Again, in theory, 150 yards, if that was the figure, it may be 150, 160, 180, but in theory, again, the same distance. In practice, of course, it depended upon how dark it was, but that was what we had attempted to do, and we certainly made a fairly determined effort to do it, because we were all scared of bombs.
How far apart were the ridges that you had to go over? You're mentioning that you saw the tail vehicle ahead of you going over a ridge, and you were rather worried about maintaining contact. But
well, you can see from that map that I've just seen, some of them may be 10 miles apart and some may be 500 yards. The desert is firstly more made of stone than sand. Secondly, it's colder rather than it's hot. But it's, apart from where it is really sandy, you have enormous trouble getting over it. And where it's really rocky, you have enormous trouble getting over it. But in between, it's very drivable. Particularly if you're used to it, and if you're in the right track with the right equipment.
But if you had plenty of ridges, presumably there are plenty of obstructions to lines of sight and lines of fire.
I don't think I've never known an obstruction to a line of fire in the desert. Other than that you tried to get 800 yards from a crest, because that was the range you could hope to take on tanks with a 25-pounder. Mm-hmm. That wasn't seen as obstruction. That was just your line of sight and where you wanted them to come over. To a gunner, the desert was a very friendly place from that point of view. If you chose the wrong position, and indeed when we eventually dropped into action on the 2nd of July, because of the way we approached the Germans that day, our first position was horrible, in that our opening range was 2,900. That's not the range to take on tanks. But that was our fault. There were no answers.
You say 800 was the range, but presumably you could actually destroy a tank at a longer range than that.
Oh yes, but at 800 yards, you could, well, again, you had Mark 3s and Mark 4s and eventually Mark 5s and Tigers, and they're all different, of course. But certainly in the period I'm thinking of, in June 42, the accepted theory was that a bowl with a crest at 800
was the optimum
for our equipment and their equipment.
What sort of range would they take you on, effectively, with their own guns, the Mark 3s and the Mark 4s?
Well, again, it depends what they're going to, what, which gun and what they're... See, when we opened up at 2,900, they got some very direct hits on some of our guns, and the shell went through the armour of the shield of a 25 pounder. But in fact, our main worries that day were not so much from the armour piercing, they were from machine gun bullets and from HE coming sideways or underneath the shield. One of the things that I've said in my note, I think, is that the gun in the Imperial War Museum is correctly shown in the yellow desert sand, but it's also got a very neat little line of sandbags around it. Well, now, if we'd had a neat little round of sandbags around us, we wouldn't have had several of the casualties we did have, because all we had, in fact, was, as we emptied tins of shell and cartridges particularly, we filled them with sand and put those round. But it was things coming underneath the shield as much as anything that caused casualties, apart from a couple of direct hits.
So the Germans could actually, from a Mark 3 or a Mark 4, they could actually hit you from 2,900?
With their machine guns, and very dangerously, yes. And all I know is we opened up at 2,900, and I know that we got a lot of casualties. Presumably they were firing from the same range as we were, I don't know. But so I wouldn't want to go into a court of law and say that they were causing that casualties at that range. But that was the range we were firing at. And we were suffering casualties.
When you fired at 800 yards, did you reckon that every shot would hit the target? Was it that certain?
I don't know that I've ever actually, personally, been lucky enough, or unlucky enough, whichever way you like to look at it, as to take on a German tank at 800 yards. But I'm pretty well convinced that if we did, I would expect to hit 9 out of 10 times, yes. That certainty of hitting, as much as anything, that's the.
And you mentioned using solid shot. Wasn't you just had solid shot rather than semi-armor piercing? Did you?
I don't know that I've ever known of semi-armor piercing in my. Certainly, we had armor piercing HE and HE cap on. The day that I'm thinking of, we fired HE cap on a lot because we didn't have a great deal of armor piercing.
So you, how long did you keep going once you'd broken out from Mercer Matruh until you stopped?
Mercer Matruh, we marched for one. We broke out that night of the 27th. We spent the night of the 28th in the desert. And I'm still trying to be quite certain whether we got into Alamein on the 29th or the 30th. But certainly we spent one night somewhere near Daba on the way back, and certainly one of the days, and this occurs in many of the accounts, and it should help me to pinpoint it in the end, is the day when there was a very heavy mist in the desert. It's mentioned in many of the histories. Unfortunately, again, many of them were 24 hours out themselves, so you're trying to cling on to a life buoy in a heavy sea. But by the 29th evening, according to my best estimate, we were back in the behind the wire at El Alamein.
What did you do when you stayed overnight? Did you form a defensive lager or anything like that? Or did you just
I imagine
stop?
So. It would be our normal practice. I should be very surprised if we didn't. But I don't remember a thing about that night. Well, we were pretty tired and don't think we had any major calls for. But we certainly drew water on El Darba Aerodrome, and there's a fairly well documented account of it being blown up at the water point. We certainly raided the Mafi there, and some people got ladies' undergarments, and others got cigarettes, and others got beer and whiskey. I wasn't, unfortunately, I was still Backstop Charlie, and they were caught up with that. But all those are documented, and it should be fairly easy to take an average on the number of different timings that people give. And we marched from there and past the Orc and into Alamein perimeter behind the wire, and I'm pretty certain that was about 4:30 in the evening, 16:30 hours on the evening of the 29th of June. It is just possible it was 24 hours later, but my plumbing is still for the 29th. Certainly the next day on the 30th, and this is probably about midday, the German patrols bumped up against the wire at El Alamein, and they fired at us, and they damaged the BQMS's, the RQMS's lorry. And that, of course, is a thing you don't forget, because when the RQMS's lorry goes, then you have a perfect alibi for the rest of the war, for your G1098 equipment.
Lost in action.
Yes. Equally, we replied, and I believe, I would be quite surprised if 11th Field Regiment wasn't the first regiment to fire at El Alamein. It's possible the South Africans, we were in their box. It's possible they also fired, but I don't think that they did, actually. I know we fired. I know we fired at that time. And if we weren't the first, we were among the first to fire at El Alamein. And we were also among the last to fire at El Alamein 4 months later, or a bit month later.
What do you mean by a German patrol? Would this be an armoured
car?
An armoured
car, I bet. I didn't see them, but there was crackling and things along the wire, and eventually a boom came our side, and I say it destroyed the RQMS's truck.
What do you mean by the wire at Alamein? Was there...
Well, we were amongst the last people to cross that bit of road. Alamein by then was almost a defended position. You will read, as you undoubtedly have, a number of histories of the war which talk of 4 prepared positions at Alamein. You'll read others that talk of 3 prepared positions at El Alamein. But all of them agree that one of them was at El Alamein itself, and one was at Himaimat down to the south, and one was at Alam Nail, I think. And the one that they never put in, or some do and some don't, is the Deir al-Shaim, because that wasn't actually built. It was on the planning bit. And this I know in some detail, because a Major General, Douglas Brown, who died recently, was the BM of Crusher Nickel, the GOC of 50 Div. But he also, in 1941, had been sent out from Cairo to prepare the position, or to survey and plan the position there. But anyway, those down south, the Deir al-Shaim was nothing. Those 2 down south, I believe there was something done. But at Alamein itself, they had been working now for perhaps 48 hours. There was a basic plan ready, and they'd been working for some time, and they had blown up holes in the ground, and they put some wire around, and you could talk of an embryonic box already in existence there on the 30th of June. It was pretty thin on the ground when you think of what it became later, but there was a wire, and there were some minefields, and there were some command posts, and there were some holes that you could shoot out of, that sort of thing. But we went through on the main road. Now, whether they actually physically closed the wire behind us, or whether we just came through a small hole that was left, or whether it was a hole like that, probably. But the wire on the road was... there was a wire. Yeah? Not much more, but a wire. We were inside it.
How far beyond the wire did you stop?
The history that I've got here says 4 miles, but I think our original stopping place was much closer than that. And I seem to remember that we actually had a sea bathe that night, the first night. We didn't stop long. We did our bit of firing and then moved back to Elimayed. Is it Elimayed station? I think it's Elimayed. And that was on the night of the 30th of June. And that is quite definite. Because at 0700 hours on the 1st of July, my CO, Colonel McCarthy, Brigadier Rob Waller, his Brigade Major Bag Jones were sitting outside Elimayed Station talking of England and particularly about Mac's young son John, whom I've seen in Godalming recently, and they were waiting for orders. Certainly Rob Waller and his Brigade Major Bag Jones hadn't had any orders for a long time. They'd
just been told to get out and wait for orders, had they?
They'd been expecting orders, but Crescent Nichols had gone off. Now, have we got some way to go on that, or are you coming to the end? Because the absence of certain people from the battlefield interests me, and you may well know the answer why, or you may be able to confirm my reason. But there are several people who were not on the battlefield on the 30th of June and the 1st of July, including the CO of the 11th HAC by the name of Leggett, including Crescent Nichols, including Brigadier Inglis of the New Zealand Division. Now, at least two of those are known to be brave men, but one of them is suspect. But they were not there. In the case of the chap from the 11th HAC, there was in fact an officer's mutiny afterwards, and